grande révolution.
The great revolution linked to Ukraine and the Russian sanctions is that if you're a purchaser of oil instead of a producer of oil, then you're going to view bilateral relations in a strictly economic manner in order to ensure your future supplies. This is going to change relations with many countries, such as Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Algeria, the UAE, and others.
Just a week ago, Macron received the head of the United Arab Emirates signing a strategic agreement to cooperate in the energy sector. The Paris visit by the de facto Saudi ruler comes 2 weeks after a visit to Riyadh by United States President Joe Biden, who backtracked on his promise to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state because of the Khashoggi murder.
Les Saoudiens, oui, un petit peu.
When it comes to the level of output, only Saudi Arabia has the ability to raise oil and gas production. Europe cannot turn to Russia anymore, and nor can they reliably turn to the US, where fracked shale gas has been a total failure. In a global climate of recession and inflation, we see no hesitation to protect energy deliveries.
Analysts say that the West is calling in their longtime support of brutal absolute monarchies and dictatorships in the Middle East, demanding that they direct their oil and gas supplies towards Europe amid the unrest in Ukraine. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Up to a quarter of the EU's electricity demand is generated using gas. In some of the bloc's member states, it is higher. As less of it arrives from Russia, EU nations have agreed to reduce gas consumption by 15% until spring.
I think at the end, everybody understands that this sacrifice is necessary. We have to, and we will share the pain.
Many in the European Parliament say the pain is not being shared equally.
Only working class people are dying, but the EU has done nothing to stop us. And so many people in here are glad the war has taken place.
Within NATO, there is opposition to Finland and Sweden joining the military alliance. Within the EU, there is opposition to the bloc's foreign policy towards Russia. There are also tensions between the EU and the UK. At present, it appears diplomacy in the West simply isn't working. Trust between allies is at an all-time low. How this will all play out is anybody's guess. It has been suggested that Russia wants Western allies to fall out.
Now is not the time for finger-pointing. We understand that they want to destroy, they want to divide, they want to split this solidarity and unity.
Critics say the West is responsible for the war in Ukraine because Russia's security concerns were ignored and even preyed upon. Experts suggest the conflict has highlighted the EU's weaknesses and has exposed the lack of energy infrastructure investment within the bloc.
That is why investing in grids, in interconnectors, in something as boring as pipelines, that matters.
Ordinary people in the EU are asking, how did we get to this point? There is a cost of living crisis and all sorts of security concerns. Analysts warn there will be political ramifications. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
South Korea will soon resume large-scale military exercises with the United States. Seoul's recently appointed foreign minister Wednesday met with the foreign press and explained the importance of the U.S. alliance in the drills.
We expect that the Ministry of National Defense will resume training to maintain the South Korea-U.S. combined defense capabilities so that South Korea's security can be maintained.
The South Korean envoy placed the responsibility for subsequent military tension on North Korea.
North Korea's nuclear and missile development and provocations are the most important causes of tension on the Korean peninsula.
North Korea recently resumed ballistic missile testing after a self-imposed moratorium aimed at negotiating a lifting of U.S.-led sanctions, which remain in effect. Meanwhile, South Korea's further developed and tested missile technology and deployed several advanced U.S. weapon systems, raising concern in Pyongyang.
The U.S. and its allies are increasing their military pressure on our republic. All this is raising serious concern that the ravages of the war 72 years ago could be repeated here. Our measures to build up national defense capabilities are the legitimate and righteous exercise of our sovereignty to defend our national security and territory against military threats.
South Korea said this year's drills will include 11 field exercises, amphibious operations, and an air carrier strike group. South Korean officials have said the joint military exercises with the U.S. will begin on August 22nd, and for the first time since 2018, include field training. As new South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol pivots to a hardline approach to Pyongyang, inter-Korean ties appear destined for greater tension. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Another day, another railway strike, bringing half of Britain's rail network to a grinding halt. Organized by the Rail, Maritime and Transport Workers Union, the 24-hour industrial action has seen more than 40,000 railway workers walk out in a row over job security and pay at a time of soaring inflation. Any hope of an 11th-hour settlement has now been all but dashed.
We're just outside one of the busiest train stations in London, where members of the RMT union have formed a picket line demanding a fair deal. And they're saying if there isn't a negotiated settlement soon, there will be more walkouts in the weeks ahead.
Those words echoed by the head of the RMT union, that industrial action is the way forward.
I can't think of a way at the moment because we've been negotiating for 2 years. But it would be interesting if me and Grant Shapps went head to head. We could see how we got on with that, if that's not too flippant.
Grant Shapps is the transport secretary. Under him, the rail network and the subway have seen billions of dollars in cuts and offered below-inflation pay rises, described by the strikers as paltry. As widespread as the disruption is support for the railway workers. Today, the strikers found Britain's shadow transport secretary joining the picket line in central London.
When Grant Shapps and Liz Truss come on the telly and say to you that it's someone else's fault, it's the striking rail workers' fault that this dispute is happening, what a load of nonsense. The Trade Union Congress had a legal opinion just a few weeks ago that showed definitively that it is the government who are agitating for this dispute. And it needs to be resolved. It needs to be resolved fairly and justly and quickly for the sake of the travelling public.
The travellers, too, want the dispute resolved quickly.
But I love the railway, I love to travel by train, I want to keep doing it, and I don't want to keep thinking, oh God, is it going to be, you know, unreliable?
Well, I totally get why they're striking. Obviously, it's an inconvenience for me, but I'm willing to make an exception.
There are more railway walkouts planned for the coming weeks. There are also reports of unrest among teaching staff and National Health Service employees. More disquiet is on the horizon as Britain awaits a new prime minister. Saeed Purizza, London.
Dismissed us and it has cost taxpayers 70.
After the warm-up bouts of debates featuring multiple leadership candidates, it was time for the final two to square off in a live televised debate. The head-to-head was the first opportunity viewers, including the estimated 170,000 members of the Conservative Party eligible to vote in the leadership race, could see Liz Truss, Foreign Secretary, face off against former Chancellor Rishi Sunak. Each wasted little time attacking each other's records and credentials and clashed heavily on their individual taxation plans to bring the country out of its worst cost of living crisis in generations.
We are an outlier. Everybody understands that COVID is a 1-in-100-year event, and trying to pay it back straight away, so quickly, that we actually damage our economy, that we end up causing a recession, that we end up in people being out of work, and that hard-working taxpayers who do the right thing have seen their taxes rise, despite the fact that we promised in our manifesto
Hang on, you just mentioned three countries. Do you know what mortgage rates are in the US at the moment? Do you want to use them as an example? Their mortgage rates are almost 50% higher than mortgage rates in this country because they're borrowing so much.
Canada actually has project fear.
The candidates vying for the country's top job have not shied away from going after each other's political juggler. Some of the exchanges have been brutal, with the former chancellor accused of talking down to his political rival, while Liz Truss has honed in on Rishi Sunak's immense wealth. Now, Tory grandees are fearful that whoever wins this vote, it's actually the Tory party with all of this mudslinging that will be the eventual loser.
Former Mayor of London Ken Livingstone has been keenly observing the leadership race. Polls have Rishi Sunak trailing Liz Truss amongst rank-and-file Tory members, and with ballot papers being sent out in early August, both candidates want to build momentum. The results of the leadership ballot will be revealed on September the 5th, still years ahead of a general election that will see the nation have the final say. Amina Taylor, London.
A UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer has been raided once again by Palestine supporters, who claim to have inflicted significant damage on the property. The building belonging to UAV Engines was hit last Sunday as part of a wider campaign by Palestine Action activists to harass and hamper the activities of the international arms firm Elbit Systems.
Palestine Action claim that their latest direct action was in retaliation to Israeli regime attacks on the Palestinian city of Nablus in the West Bank on Sunday morning, killing at least two Palestinians and injuring many more. The group also vows that as long as Israeli aggression against Palestine continues, so will their campaign, targeting not just Israeli arms manufacturers in the UK, but also their partners as well.
Following Sunday's action, supporters gathered to protest outside UAV's gates in solidarity with the activists who were detained following the direct action.
The drone parts that are made here are used, are tested on the captive population of Gaza. We know that these drones have killed people, and we're here today to stop the arms trade overall, but specifically against Elbit.
Palestine Action have always said, if you continue with this violence against the Palestinian people, then we will retaliate, we will resist, we will come back, we will shut down your factories.
The attack by Israel on Nablus is a common occurrence across occupied Palestine. The lack of action by Western powers to rein in Israeli aggression has inspired more aggressive activism. Palestine Action say their relentless raids have successfully forced the closure of two Elbit sites in London and Oldham. A spokesperson for Elbit acknowledged the incident, claiming it was an attack by a violent group. Although no one was harmed during the raid, Palestine Action's sites remain squarely fixed on UAV engines, so locals can expect more of the same scenes going forward. Robert Carter, Shenstone.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran has issued a warning about Israel's nuclear arsenal, in particular its nuclear warheads, which is estimated to number between 200 to 400. This is while Israel has not only been claiming that Iran is just a short time away from obtaining the bomb, it has also threatened Iran with military action. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how it is that Israel and not Iran, who is a threat not only to the Islamic Republic, but also to the West Asia region as a whole. But first, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joins us from Marseille, France. Also joining us, former U.S. government advisor Paul Larudi, who joins us from Berkeley.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
To you both. Paul Larudi, I'm going to first start with you. I'm curious as to why Israel is pursuing a policy of what they call deliberate ambiguity about its nuclear weapons, when it is very well known that it does possess between 200 to 400 of them, warheads in particular. Not only the former U.S. President Jimmy Carter has said that, but you also have that whistleblower Vanunu who has claimed that. But why does it pursue this policy of what it calls nuclear ambiguity?
There's a very simple answer to that, and that is that the U.S. Congress has passed, the U.S. government has passed legislation saying that the U.S. cannot provide aid of any kind to any country that possesses nuclear weapons and develops nuclear weapons. Therefore, since this is an agreement between Israel and the United States, and the State Department of the United States every year certifies that they have no evidence that Israel possesses nuclear weapons, in which case it is permissible to provide Israel with aid. That's the bottom line. That's the bottom line. There are other reasons that Israel considers it advantageous, but this is the main one that began decades ago.
Like, what are the reasons that it does not want to claim that you said are advantageous for not stating it?
Well, they can't be held in non-compliance with various international treaties if they don't belong to those treaties, and if they supposedly don't have nuclear weapons, and they can't be held accountable, I think, on a variety of metrics, means of judging them. They can't be held accountable if it's not certain that they have these weapons.
Okay, Elijah Magner, we have what Iran has stated, and many are also questioning as to why you have the NPT, and when you have the threat that are posed by nuclear weapons, that Israel, which again, even though they don't want to admit it, but have 200 to 400 of these nuclear warheads, are not a member of the NPT. Iran says it should be a member of the NPT, the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. And the big question is, why isn't the IAEA actually fulfilling its responsibility in this regard to pursue this matter with Israel? Of course, Iran is saying that because it's also being threatened by Israel militarily, but above and beyond that, Israel keeps accusing Iran of pursuing a path towards weaponizing its nuclear program.
Thank you for having me. The answer is quite simple. The IAEA was formed in 1957 by the Americans, and since the 1957, the Israelis were engaged at the beginning with a building a nuclear reactor with the help of France, Norway, and the Americans. And since then, the IAEA never inspected the Israeli nuclear plant. It was only later when Ben-Gurion admitted that the Dimona was hosting what used to be a textile factory, in fact, was a nuclear reactor. And the reason why the Israelis said for the first time, we're talking about in 1962, 1963, when they admitted the first time that they may have developed a nuclear weapons in their what used to be called textile factory, only deterrent to Arab actions against Israel. So since then, the Americans have created the Atom for Peace program at the time of President Eisenhower and camouflage the Israeli reactor and the Israeli development of nuclear weapons. It was since then that the Americans planned to hide what the Israelis are doing to prevent the IAEA that was formed by the Americans to go and inspect what the Israelis have and to make sure that the public and the world is aware of the Israeli nuclear capability. Instead, they've hidden all that. The French has hidden all that. Norway hidden all that. And they all aware, the international community is aware, because they have, Norway provided 20 tons of water for the reactor, and France provided the reactor. So they all know what's happening in Israel. They all know about the weapon that Israel have. And also, we know that the Israelis were about to use nuclear weapon during the 6 days war with the Arabs. So now, failing to expose all that and to open the site to international community and international supervision, it shows us first that international supervision is not international, but is under the thumb of the Americans. Second, that everything the Israelis are doing is covered and supported by the Americans. Third, it's a cherry picking for the Americans to go and accuse Iran and Korea and China and the countries that are not friendly to the U.S. and push the IAEA to go inspect what they are doing with the nuclear reactor, if it is for peace or for weapon purposes.
Well, one of the things that happens when you have a nuclear reactor is the fact that it poses a threat or a danger to the environment, Paula Rudy, and given the fact that it's not under the IAEA supervision, as we understand, that this in particular obviously provides a threat to the West Bank. You have nuclear waste that it is alleged that the Israel is burying in the West Bank. Shouldn't that be a matter of concern?
Of course it's a matter of concern, especially to the Palestinians themselves. But this is, again, nothing new. Israel has used the occupied territories as a dumping ground for all sorts of toxic waste and materials. And they consider this a way of continuing the genocide of the Palestinians, destroying the Palestinian people, at least those that are, well, in general, the Palestinian people, both those who are under their direct rule and those that are not, even outside. They've done similar things in Lebanon, for example, and Syria and so forth. They consider it an advantage to be able to put toxic materials where they want to make life miserable, difficult, and even to end life for the people that they want to get rid of. So this is just part of their policy of genocide.
You had an idea that came up during the former president, Iranian president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Elijah Magnier, and that was a West Asia or Middle East free zone, as he called it during that time. And just recently, again, Iran's deputy ambassador to the UN has drawn attention to this establishment of a zone free of WMDs, weapons of mass destruction, of which it was actually initiated by Iran at the UN. Israel is against that, does not want that. Coming from Iran and the fact that Israel does not want that, what message is that sending?
Iran is sending a message that the Middle East, as the rest of the world, should be free of weapons of mass destruction. However, this is not what the Americans want. So if we look at all the American administrations, starting from Eisenhower to Kennedy to Johnson to Nixon, they all hide and hid all the Israeli capability for one purpose, is to keep a deterrence in the Middle East against the U.S. allies, against the U.S. enemies. So when Iran is coming out with a proposal saying we want the Middle East without weapons of mass destruction, is really targeting only Israel because it's the only place where there are weapons of mass destruction. And this goes against the U.S. and the Israeli policy that want Israel to remain as the policeman of the region, which is not something that Iran accepts. And also all the country where there is a population that stands against the normalization with Israel and refuse what the Israeli did by occupying the Palestinian territory. So by Iran saying, I want this, a Middle East or an area or half of the world or whatever, free of weapons of mass destruction, it goes against the U.S. and the Israeli policy that the U.S. will certainly refuse to abide by and will completely ignore the call for a weapons of mass destruction, which is obviously that is directed only toward Israel, and the Americans are not ready to compromise anything what they call the security of the Israelis.
Paula Rudy, I think you also had a response to that.
Mr. Manier is exactly correct. And the United States does not want to give up an advantage or the advantage of its ally, or Israel is just basically an extension of the United States, or you could say the United States is an extension of Israel, if you like. But they have an advantage, which are the nuclear weapons, and they can always threaten others with them and cause problems, as we've already discussed. So this is they want to keep that advantage, and the idea of a nuclear-free or a nuclear weapons-free Middle East is they're not willing to consider it, and they don't have to, because they're the power in the region.
But when you take a look at Israel, Elijah Magnier, Israel is the only entity right now that is not only attacking a sovereign nation repeatedly, namely Syria. It has actually attacked Syria's nuclear facilities at one point in order to, based on its views, to stop the further investment of its nuclear program. At the same time, it is threatening Iran militarily. So when you have an entity that is reacting that way and carries out operations like that, military operations, isn't then Israel at the highest risk of proliferation or using nuclear weapons?
Indeed, it is. Israel did not attack Syria's site only. It has attacked also Iraq in the 80s to stop Iraq from developing its nuclear capability. So any country that stands as strong in competition with Israel, Israel reacts to it with the full support of the United States of America. Now, Israel represents a danger because the Israelis are really looking to attack any country that, for them, can create a threat to Israel. Now, the only threat in the region is Israel itself. It's violated the Lebanese air space, to violate Syrian airspace, to bomb Lebanon, to bomb Syria, to bomb Iraq. They bombed many sites of the Hashd al-Shaabi and the Iraqi security forces, attacks in Iran and assassination. So it's Israel that is taking always initiative and is the first aggressor. Now, as long as it has what Israel called a deterrence, a nuclear deterrence, at the end of the day, I don't think this is a point of strength for Israel, because we've seen how Russia in Ukraine was not able to use its nuclear weapons. However, that doesn't justify that Israel needs to go unchecked and for the world to keep looking the other way about what the Israelis are doing and what are their nuclearity is in the Negev and the Dimona and what they are doing there and how they are developing, and if that represents a danger to the civilian population.
Well, you have obviously the one of the most important standoffs that can occur because of the way that Israel acts, and that is when it comes to Iran. We have seen what Israel has done in terms of acts of sabotage against Iran, from the assassinations of a number of nuclear scientists to facilities itself, which the most recent one was in Karaj, and one of the most recent developments also was how an Israeli spy cell was actually caught, and one of the revelations was that they wanted to lay bombs at a sensitive site in Esfahan, which according to one report they had already gone through and done that. So aren't these all signs that there needs to be some restriction, some oversight then, back to the question, through the relevant organization, which at this point is the IAEA, in order to stop anything from happening?
Well, neither the IAEA nor the United Nations nor any other organization is going to stop Israel from doing whatever it feels like doing, as long as it feels that it has the power to do it without consequences to itself. And that's unfortunately the situation, and it's the situation of its sponsor, the United States as well. Both entities will do whatever they can to make others subservient to them and to enhance their control of various parts of the world, the population, the economy, the territory. We can talk about what the law says and what morality says and all of these things, but in the end, it is strength that talks. It is power that talks, And Israel is going to use whatever power it has in order to cause disaster for its neighbors, to keep its neighbors in check, and also to use its power to enhance, to enlarge its territory and increase its own power over its neighbors. And that's the same as same applies to the United States, which, as I said before, is just an one is the extension of the other.
Well, Elijah Magner, Israel has sounded the alarm over Iran on so many occasions when it comes to its civilian nuclear program. A quick question that comes about during these times where we're looking at the revival of the JCPOA, if there's even a point of saying the revival if it's not dead yet, is why doesn't the U.S. just make the political decision to get back into the deal that the U.S. pulled out from in the first place in order to, in their eyes, eliminate any chances that there may be, in their eyes again, for Iran to pursue any type of weaponization of their program, which will then, by default, leave only Israel with nuclear weapons in West Asia?
Because when you give the Americans a finger, they won't. The problem is Iran is negotiating the Americans in good faith, but the Americans and the Europeans are in 2018. One is the American, Donald Trump, just threw away the JCPOA, and the Europeans find themselves withdrawing from Iran and not abiding by their signature. So you are dealing with Western organizations that just want to impose their will and dominate whoever country that is ready to be dominated. Iran is not on the list of dominated countries for the West. And by showing its rejection of the U.S. supremacy and the U.S. control and hegemony, Iran became the enemy. So whatever Iran is doing and offering, the Americans are trying to have a deal where they keep having the upper hand over the Iranians. And Iran is trying to say that we want a deal where we are both equal, where this is the big mistake Iran is doing, because the Americans are not interested in becoming an equal partner in this deal because they are not a viable partner. They want the upper hand, and they want to make sure that they can return to the sanctions against Iran, because you are dealing with Western, not international organizations like the IAEA that brings out of the hat all the rabbits they want against Iran whenever they want, because they are pushed by the United States. And then you negotiate a peace, a deal that the JCPOA is saying, I agree to control my nuclear program that is weapon-free. And they say, no, but we want to impose sanctions on your institutions because whenever we want, we can cripple your economy. So you are both talking different languages, and it is like you don't understand each other, because the American side is not ready to sit on the table as an equal partner. The Americans want the upper hand. That is the point.
Okay, we got about 30 seconds to give to you, Paula Rudy. You had a statement coming out from the former Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, that was interesting, that said Iran can transform itself into a nuclear power and it's too late to stop it by surgical attack. Of course, he goes on to say, again, talk about the timeline here, that it will take Iran 18 to 24 months in order to reach that, what did he call it, treating metal, uranium, and picking it. Well, he talked technically there. You know, you have the threat, and then, but it takes a couple of years, even though the threat is going to take a couple of weeks. Never understood how they always talk about weeks away, and we can go back to 20 years ago up to now. Anyways, what is interesting about this is the fact that you have Israel, who is very much against this JCPOA revival. Why would Israel really be against this if it feels threatened in any shape or form? By Iran pursuing, again, in its eyes, a nuclear weaponization program?
Well, the answer is that Israel does not feel threatened by it, and it considers that it can take whatever measures it needs in order to remain more powerful, especially in terms of nuclear weapons. It's not really afraid of Iran acquiring nuclear weapons, most of all because of the policies of the government. The government of Iran has said repeatedly that it has no interest in acquiring nuclear weapons and is not pursuing any nuclear weapons. So this, I think this is not an issue.
Thank you very much for that. Paul Rudy there, former U.S. government advisor. And thank you, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst. Both of you, thank you for your input. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tapway and the team. It's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Major U.S. gun companies that manufactured the weapons behind many mass shootings made over $1 billion in revenue over 10 years, selling hundreds of thousands of assault weapons to the public each year, according to a new report from House investigators released recently. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Sharon Zhang, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Gun Makers Have Made $1 Billion from Assault Weapons Sales Over the Past Decade. Stay tuned for more. Major U.S. gun companies that manufactured the weapons behind many mass shootings made over $1 billion in revenue over 10 years, selling hundreds of thousands of assault weapons to the public each year, according to a new report from House investigators released recently. The House Oversight Committee report finds that five major manufacturers collected this revenue solely from the sales of military-style assault weapons to civilians, like AR-15-style semi-automatic guns. AR-15-style semi-automatic weapons are the gun of choice for many mass shooters, including the gunman responsible for the recent massacre of Uvalde, Texas. How much are the lives of America's children, teachers, parents, and families worth to gun manufacturers? Said Oversight Committee Chair Representative Caroline Meloni in a statement, adding, these companies are selling the weapons of choice for mass murderers who terrorize young children at school, hunt down worshippers at churches and synagogues, and slaughter families on the 4th of July. In short, the gun industry is profiting off the blood of innocent Americans, unquote. Lawmakers' findings are based on letters sent to manufacturers Daniel Defense, Smith & Wesson Brands, Sturm, Roger & Company, Sig Sauer, and Bushmaster Firearms Industries, who they say use disturbing sales tactics to market their products to young men. Materials obtained by the committee show how sellers tout assault rifles' military pedigree. Wine manufacturers make sly references to violent white supremacists like Bugalda Boys, lawmakers wrote. Such weapons can often be purchased on credit, with Daniel Defense bragging that financing is approved in seconds, the report finds. These companies made the guns behind the slew of mass shootings, the report says. Daniel Defense, whose revenue from AR-15-style weapons tripled from $40 million to $120 million between 2019 and 2021, made the rifle that was used to kill 19 children and two teachers at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. Investigators also found that the shooter who carried out the deadliest mass shooting in modern history, the 2017 shooting in Las Vegas, had four Daniel Defense manufactured guns in his collection. Smith & Wesson, which was the second largest manufacturer of rifles in the U.S. in 2020, sold the assault weapons used in the mass shooting in Highland Park, Illinois, earlier this month. The 2018 massacre at Majority Stoneman High School in Parkland, Florida, and the 2015 shooting at the Social Services Center in San Bernardino, California. The company more than doubled its revenue from all long guns, including AR-15-style rifles, between 2019 and 2020, from $108 million to $253 million. Sig Sauer, which did not disclose its revenue, sold the assault weapon that was used to massacre 49 people and injure 53 others at a nightclub in Florida in 2016, the nation's second deadliest shooting in modern history. It also sold three of the weapons used by the shooter in 2016 in Las Vegas mass shooting. Sturm, Roger & Company, the largest rifle maker in the U.S., made the AR-15-style rifle and pistols that were used in mass shootings at a supermarket in Boulder, Colorado in 2021 and at a church in Sutherland Springs, Texas in 2017, which was the deadliest shooting in Texas at the time. Roger's gross earnings from AR-15-style rifles nearly tripled between 2019 and 2021, from $39 million to $103 million. Finally, Bushmaster, which claimed it couldn't report its revenue because it was recently bought by another company, made the gun that a white supremacist used to kill 10 people and injure three others in May at a supermarket in a majority black neighborhood in Buffalo, New York. Bushmaster assault weapon was also used in the mass shooting in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012 when a shooter opened fire on children in Sandy Hook Elementary School, the deadliest school shooting in the U.S. history. The manufacturers all say that they have no way to collect and report safety data, including deaths or injuries, related to their products. Bushmaster went so far as to say that it was aware of no such deaths or injuries due to its recent acquisition by another brand. These spikes in revenues follow long-standing trends, finding that gun sales peak following civil unrest, elections, and mass shootings. Gun manufacturers not only acknowledge these patterns, but also market them as sales opportunities to investors, the report says. The report was released before an oversight committee hearing on the role of gun manufacturers in gun violence in the U.S., one in a series of hearings by the group to investigate the gun violence epidemic. It comes as lawmakers are considering an assault weapons ban, which recently passed the committee vote in the House. Data shows that assault weapons bans are effective in preventing gun violence. Research has found that after President Bill Clinton signed an assault weapon ban in 1994, mass shootings and gun deaths fell in the 10 years that the ban was active. But after lawmakers allowed the ban to end in 2004, mass shootings and gun deaths both roughly doubled.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up...